Welcome back to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have John Massaro on the show. He is the author of Will Vaccines Be the End of Us? His website is endtheshots.com, correct?
That's it, Tim.
And that's you can get the book there. I understand it's also posted at the American Free Press?
Yes. Yeah, they sell it as well. You can get it. People can get it from me directly, or they can read it for free on my website. The whole thing is up there in PDF form.
Okay. Well, the book is very expansive. It's about a lot more than just, of course, vaccines, because the whole vaccine agenda might be related to perhaps wider problems that we're confronted with, the corruption of the entire system. I mean, you begin discussing vaccines, smallpox, polio, and the myths that have enabled the corruption of the public health, medical establishments. But it also goes into perhaps how this corruption has metastasized and affecting the entire body politic, our entire modern world. But let's, how do you want to start off talking about this? Why'd you write the book?
Well, do you want me to tell my story? I mean, you've read the beginning. It's, I think, if people haven't read it or aren't familiar with me, I'll just give you a rundown on how I got interested in this. Let me just begin by saying I was born in 1953. I'll be turning 70 next month. Can't believe that. But, you know, I was born at a time when I don't know, I think you're in your mid-50s, am I right?
About right, yeah, it's about right.
Okay. Well, I'm a little older than you, but I don't know how many vaccines you got as a child. I got a total of 6 doses. I got deep, I guess when I was an infant, I got DPT, polio, and smallpox, which was discontinued in, I think, 1971. And then when I was in the third grade, this would be 1961, they snuck in another polio shot. They went from the Sox injected dead virus or weakened virus polio vaccine to Sabin's live vaccine, which was the sugar cube. I don't know if you had that, but that was the end of it for me. 6 doses by the time I was 8. And then, you know, compared to what the CDC recommends today, 72 doses. And here in New York, school children are required by the time they graduate high school to have received 41 doses. So it's a very different world. But as far as my awareness of vaccines, the first thing I remember, I was in the fifth grade, and my fifth grade teacher taught us about Jonas Salk and his wonderful miracle polio vaccine, which I later found out was a lot of baloney. But anyway, I never gave it much thought. I questioned a lot of things when I was a kid, but that sounded pretty pretty credible to me, so I never questioned that. I never even thought about it. I do remember in 1976, summer of 76, I would have been, 22 years old, they had the swine flu scare. It was nothing. It was similar to what happened with COVID, but really on a much, much smaller scale. I mean, it wasn't, you know, people weren't required to get it, and it wasn't really the big issue that the COVID vaccine became. But I do remember there was a lot of pressure. I remember my parents pleading with me to go get it, and it was just something about the stampede. I just sensed something about this fear-mongering, and I just couldn't see it. So I never bothered getting it. And then as it turned out, I think there was something like, I don't remember the exact number, I think something like 40 people died of it, and several hundred came down with a very bad reaction, Guillain-Barré syndrome. And after, I think, 3 or 4 months, they just discontinued the whole thing. They pretty much admitted, tacitly admitted that it was a failure. But I never really thought about that. I just said to myself, you know, it's just a fluke. You know, I never took any interest in it. The first time it became vaccines became important to me was in 1981. I traveled. I should say I was an oil truck driver. Well, I don't want to go over all my biographical details, but through the 70s, I kind of just kind of floundered around. I hitchhiked around the country. I had menial jobs, and I dropped in and out of college and finally graduated college at the end of the 70s. But I accidentally fell into the home heating oil business. I learned how to drive a truck, and that that occupation, it gets very slow in the summertime. And I was always curious about seeing the world. As a little kid, I was always wondered about distant countries, distant peoples. So that job gave me the opportunity, since it got very slow, really completely dead in the summer. I was able to travel through most of the 1980s each year for about 3 months, on average about 3 months. And in 1981, I went to West Africa, six countries in West Africa. And some of those countries required a yellow fever vaccination and cholera vaccination. And this was recorded in a little yellow booklet. So I said, okay, you know, I had never heard a bad word about vaccines. So I got my first yellow fever and cholera shots at the Kennedy Airport Medical Building in New York. And I had to go back a couple of weeks. This is like three months before the trip, I should say. And I had to go back and get a yellow fever booster. And I didn't have a bad reaction. And again, it was just these shots, the dates and the lot number was recorded in this little booklet. And I continued each summer from 1981 through 86 to travel in different parts of the third world, around Africa, Asia, South America. And each year, having never heard a bad word about vaccines, I just went back and got another one. I got cholera boosters each year for 6 years straight. And in addition, I got a typhoid. And the last 84, 85, and 86, I also got gamma globulin as a preventive against hepatitis A, which is very common in the third world. And I never had, I would say in total over those 6 years, I got about between 15 and 18 shots. You know, most of them were recorded in my little booklet. Some weren't. As I said, I never had a bad immediate reaction. I never had an adverse reaction. Now, the first time it became an issue, I traveled in 86. I went to, 86, I went to Morocco, and I combined that with France, Spain, and Morocco. And then I quit my job, and from December to December 86 to March of 87, I traveled around India, Nepal, Bangladesh, and Burma, which is called Myanmar these days. And this is the first time it became an issue for me. I got more shots in November of 86 before I left home. And when I was in Nepal, early January of 87, I ran into two Australian women who I was interested in doing a little trekking, you know, not at really high altitudes, but I just wanted to do a little trekking, maybe 4 days. So I bumped into two Australian women who were interested in doing the same thing. And we got to talking. We were in the capital, Kathmandu. We went to a travel office and just put a little customized trek of 4 days, four nights together, you know, with porters, you know, to put up our tents and cook our meals, that kind of thing. And I think it was the second night. We were sitting around, they had made a fire for us. We were sitting around a fire, drinking tea, just chatting. And, you know, when you travel in the third world, lots of times you meet other travelers and you swap advice, you know, health advice. You know, you talk about health matters, you know, because a lot of people get sick. Well, I got sick several times, and nothing really bad except once, but I won't go into that. Anyway, we're sitting around the fire talking, and I just casually mentioned that I got a gamma globulin shot, you know, as a preventive against hepatitis A. And one of them said, oh, we didn't get that shot. So I said, why not? So they said, well, you know, there's a big controversy in Australia right now because that shot is made from other people's blood. There's a big controversy as to whether you can get AIDS from it. And when I heard those words, I almost passed out. I must have turned green. I said to myself, other people's blood. You know, nobody had ever, whenever I got those shots at Kennedy Airport, no nurse had ever mentioned any of the ingredients. And, you know, at that time, I just wondered, and this was a time when AIDS was taking quite a toll, mostly on the homosexual community. But also there were about 1,000 recipients of blood transfusion, hemophiliacs and surgery patients who had died of AIDS from getting contaminated blood transfusions. And, you know, when I heard other people's blood, I just said to myself, am I a dead man walking? I said, I was just absolutely horrified. And that was labor's like this was like I had just gotten my third shot in 3 consecutive years. So you know, well, listen, I didn't get AIDS, but I said to myself, I thought to myself, I didn't really think about it at the time, but I said to myself, what is wrong with you? I thought to myself later, what is wrong with these nurses not telling me? You know, if they had told me that it was made from other people's blood, there's no way in the world I would have gotten that shot. Because actually, I hadn't gotten it when I went to Africa 2 years in a row, 81 and 82, and you know, I didn't come down with hepatitis. You know, it was just a shock. It was just my first realization that this whole industry is just, they just lie, lie. That was just an example of lying by omission. Because if they notif if they told people the truth about what's in these vaccines and all of them, you know, nobody would get the damn things. So anyway, a few years later, I got married, and I was in my late 30s then, and my ex-wife was in her mid-30s, and you know, right away we tried to start having children, and time went by and nothing happened. And during that time, she was a little bit into the alternative health movement, and she listened to a show by Gary Null. I don't know, maybe you've heard of him, Gary Null. Yeah, okay. And he was very, very dead against vaccines. And he had recommended a book. He had mentioned a book on his show, Neil Miller's Vaccines, Are They Really Safe and Effective? And she said, so she ordered the book. It was a very short book, about 70 pages. And she read it. She said, you really ought to read this. And I read that book. And when I read that book, lightning just struck me. I said, there's another side to the story of this whole vaccine business. I never heard it in my life. I never heard a bad word about vaccines. And I just said then and there, I said, this is just incredible. How come I never heard? I was 33. Well, I was, I guess, yeah, at the time. No, I was a little older than 33. I was 33 when I was in Nepal. I was about 37 then. And I said, you know, how come I never heard anything about this? This is just incredible. You know, I made up my mind right then and there that I would never get another shot. And then if we had children, they wouldn't be vaccinated. And to make a long story short, we went for years without her getting pregnant. Finally, we went to in vitro. We went to a fertility specialist, had in vitro, went through the in vitro procedure. Actually, we did it like 3 different cycles. It was just a very long, difficult time. The third time, these fertility doctors gave us really bad advice, and we did something foolish. To make a long story short, she did get pregnant with twins, but there were a lot of con she had a very complicated pregnancy, and my children were born, boy and a girl, twins. They were born 3 months premature, and you know, when that happens, you just hope against hope that they're going to turn out okay. But it didn't happen that way for us. They were in the ICU for 3 months. And my daughter had a lot of brain bleeding. My son also, but not as badly. And you know, eventually they came out. And actually, the day my daughter was released from the hospital, they did a scan on her brain, and there was a lot of dead tissue. So as it turned out, you know, a few years later, we realized she was, you know, from that extensive brain damage, she was autistic. And but both of my kids had mild cerebral palsy. Right, by the way, they're okay. They're going to be 30 in March, and they're doing okay health-wise. But my daughter is in a group home, severely autistic, and my son turned out a little better. He lived with my ex-wife for quite some time, and now he's kind of on his own. But he has to. She put him like in a home where he's like semi independent, but not really. He can't. I mean, there's a lot of things he won't be able to do. He can't. He's basically mildly retarded, okay? But what I've been able to do things with him, taking him places. I've taken him to Europe a few times, but he's gone camping and fishing many times. We've had some good times together, but he can't. He'll never be able to live independently. So, and I should have said earlier when I did more research when she was, well, when my wife was was unable to get pregnant, and I found out that vaccines, you know, once I read that Miller book, I started reading reading more, and I learned that they can provoke all kinds of autoimmune reactions. And what the fertility doctors told me was that there was antibodies on my sperm cells. That's why she wasn't getting pregnant. So one of the procedures they did was just, you know, washing antibodies off my sperm cells. So, and you know, that kind of thing, that kind of condition is just freakish. I don't think it exists anywhere in nature. You know, so I was able to put two and two together. I can't imagine any other reason why that had come about in me. So, you know, I kind of, then and there I said, I really became obsessed with the subject and just the whole criminality of the whole thing, the lying by commission, the lying by omission. I started reading more books. And in 2008, I decided to write my own book. I said, I've learned enough about this. I'm going to write my own book. So I worked on my book, Will Vaccines Be the End of Us, for about 10 years, I guess, constantly revising it, researching it, the subject further. Although it gets monotonous after a while, there's really nothing. Once you've researched and studied it for, 15 years, there's really nothing left to learn. Yeah, the whole picture becomes very clear. So the way I feel about it now is that the entire, all vaccination is a fraud. And eventually, I think it's going to go the way of other medical delusions of the past, like bloodletting and variolation. So, you know, I don't believe in this safe and fit. We just need to find a way to make vaccines safe. That's just a lot of baloney. There's never been a safe vaccine. They've always been problematic from day one, going all the way back to Jenner in 1796. So, as I said, in 2008, I decided to write my own book, and for about 10 years, you know, I worked on it constantly, revised it, continued to do research, and rewrote other parts. I wasn't sure how to write this book because there really are some excellent books out there that really tell the full truth about vaccines. So I wanted to write something different. As you mentioned at the beginning, I go into a lot of different areas. I kind of wanted to tie all the I don't know, how should I put it? All the delusions and the everything bad about human nature, including what's happening now, you know, in this country, around the world. I just wanted to tie everything together. So that's what I did. And, you know, let people judge the book for themselves. I never wrote it to make money. I only had 1,000 copies printed. I haven't sold that many through, I have my website, but I don't do social media, that might change actually, but I don't do social media. And I've been doing, you know, like interviews like this and getting word out. I've given the book away to certain organizations that I support. I'll let them and encourage them to sell it. And that's where I stand. That brings me up to the present. So, I don't know. Do you want to talk about maybe do you have any questions at this point? I mean, you said before you went on that you've pretty much, you know, have studied the subject yourself. So I don't know if you disagree with anything I've said or if you have any questions.
If one does a little research, one looks into the history of, you mentioned it, the vaccines, particularly Edward Jenner and the fraud behind that case, and polio, some of these, you know, very famous, you know, cases where supposedly these were miracle cures and drugs, and it simply isn't the case with polio, and even the cause of polio, because there's a big question actually what caused the paralysis, all they did to cure polio is they just redefined it. You know, they changed the diagnostic parameters. They extended the amount of paralysis, the amount of time you had to be paralyzed. That's how they cured it. And it creates a lot of problems because you mentioned in the book something with polio where, of course, it was attainted with the SV40 virus, which some people think is the cause of the soft tissue cancer epidemic we're experiencing now.
Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned that the way they changed the name and they changed the definition. That was one thing that Miller brought out in his book. How they stopped calling it polio and started calling it aseptic meningitis. just to cover up the fact that the vaccine was not working, and all kinds of monkey business.
Well, it's funny because actually they grew the what the cultures on monkey
Yeah,
cults.
speaking of monkeys, I was going to say, and it just shows the kind of people they are. They just use these monkeys. I mean, they went through like, this is like in the early 50s. Well, Salk vaccine came out in April of 1955, and they had been working on a vaccine for more than that, about at least 10 years. And they went through 100, from what I've read, they went through like 100,000 monkeys. And, they were just captured in the wild, I think mostly in the Philippines. They were brought here just living miserable lives. And they just experimented on them, and they just, in the end, they just ended up killing them, just throwing them out like used paper towels. So that shows the kind of mentality of these people that get involved in vaccine work. So, but, it goes all the way back to – a lot of people don't realize that – it goes all the way back to Edward Jenner. Most people recognize that the first vaccine administered was it May 14th, 1796. And as soon as people heard about what he had done, I'm sure you know this story. He took some cow pus from a young milkmaid who was infected with what they call cowpox. She had, I think, blisters on her hand. And he took the pus out of that, and he inserted it into an 8-year-old boy named James Phipps. He inserted the cow pus into some cuts on his arm, just experimenting on him. And then he just dabbled a little bit here and there, and then I think he put smallpox, and then I think the boy became he got cowpox, but then he tried inserting the same thing, well, a smallpox into his arm. And I think he tried this on a few other people, and when they didn't come down with smallpox, he proclaimed that it was a success. His vaccine was a success. And as soon as people heard about this, they really, it's funny. A lot going back to the very end of the 18th century in England, it's almost like the same thing with COVID today. I mean, there were a certain amount of people that were just horrified by it. By what he was doing, and some people that said, "Hey, maybe he's onto something here. Maybe this is the way to end smallpox." But it was actually, in 1802, there's a famous picture. You can find this. Maybe you've seen it. In 1802, there was a painter named James Gilray, and he came up with a portrait of people. All these people in a room. Growing, cow faces and horns out of their bodies. So it seems like even back then, even though this so much less was known than today, people just had the common sense to realize you don't put material from cow, biological material from a cow, into the human bloodstream. So that was 1802, and then Jenner died in 1823, but. For the rest of his life, through the first part of the 19th century, he was constantly being called out. He was constantly making excuses because, as the smallpox vaccine caught on, people were still getting smallpox. People were having terrible reactions to it. And it was like nothing but he just came up with one alibi after the next. Then he went from cowpox to inserting horse. There was a disease in horses called glue. Their hooves became infected, so he took that and he used that as a vaccine. And certain people that had good intuition said this is just crazy. We don't know what's going on. But eventually, he was able to convince Parliament that his vaccine worked, and that was and that's what got the ball rolling. Then by 1853. Parliament passed a law making vaccination compulsory for infants, and that's as I said, the anti-vax movement pretty much started as soon as people heard about what he had done in 1796. But in 1853, that's when really people really started becoming outraged, and there was a lot of it really became an issue because once it became mandatory and people were fined. I think they were given jail terms as well. Not long jail terms, but they were fined. And that really got the controversy really boiling. And it's been going on ever since, really. People don't realize that. I mean, they hear the word anti-vax and they think it's just something recent. No, it started, it's been going on for well over 200 years. And it's just that other side of the story that people never hear. So,
well, didn't outbreaks occur after inoculation, so called?
Oh yeah,
yeah. So if you just look at that, that's obviously reasons to be skeptical of the, of the.
You were asking if outbreaks had occurred after.
Yeah.
Definitely. I mean, that was part of the whole controversy, and this just went on. As in my chapter on smallpox, I just mentioned a lot of the dissenting doc. You know, it was like a dogma. I mean, people get hooked on dogma, just like today. I mean, they've heard a million times, you know, vaccines have saved millions of lives, and only nut jobs, you know, anti-vaxxers are just nutty. They reject science. They're flat earthers, mm-hmm. this and that. So it was like a dogma. And they didn't want to look at, but there were plenty of dissenting doctors. I quoted some of them in my chapter on smallpox. And, you know, the controversy, actually, smallpox really was probably the most, well, not probably, definitely the most controversial vaccine of all. You know, maybe because it was around for so long. And,
but don't they still claim to eradicate it through vaccination?
Yeah, that's what they claim. But then, you know, there was, you know, as I wrote in my book, I don't know if you read that part, there was other poxes breaking out.
Oh, monkey pox, right?
Yeah, monkey pox. Very, very recently, actually. I think there was an outbreak in Uganda, one in the country of Georgia, a few other countries. And, you know, and this is probably just another case of them, giving it a different name just to
Is it a type of disease that's sort of poverty-driven or behavior-driven? Obviously, the monkeypox of the summer of 2022 apparently was male homosexuals. And, of course, they were describing certain types of behavior which spread it, unhealthy behavior which normal people would not engage in, like being in tight, close spaces with your clothes off, you know, a bathhouse, an orgy, if you will. Or like in Uganda where you have, you know, any number of other issues like malnutrition and toxins and poisons.
Absolutely. You know. Malnutrition is a big thing. I mean, but I just want to say, after all my research, I just go back to the simplest thing in the world, and that was what, you know, we live in such a world of just constant lies. So I've learned to, you don't know what to believe. You know, a lot of people say this, you know, just don't know what to believe anymore. Mm-hmm. The only thing I can believe is what I've seen with my own eyes. And when I was a kid, as I said, we only had six doses. And when I was going to school, elementary school in the early 60s, there were quite a few kids who got chickenpox and measles. And more rarely, mumps and what they called back then was German measles.
Yeah, these were trivial childhood diseases.
Trivial. I mean, I can remember.
I had them. I had them when I was a kid. I had German measles, chicken pox.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah.
You were off of school for a week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a little rest, and you were back in school. It was not a big deal. And just in the past few decades, maybe starting 30 years ago, all of a sudden measles kills, you know?
Yes.
You know, I'm sure maybe one in 10,000 cases it does kill. But, you know, I just remember what I saw as a kid. The kids that came, me, fortunately, I never came down with any of the childhood diseases. Now, I have three siblings. I have a younger brother and two younger sisters. My brother got chickenpox. The older of my two sisters got chickenpox and measles. And my younger sister, like me, she avoided all of them. So, and we all had the same. Only my younger sister, who was born in 1962, she did get the measles vaccine, not the MMR. That came later.
Yeah, yeah, that's cocktail.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's if you watch television, perception, this is where memory is important, there's I think, an episode of the Brady Bunch where they all get measles, and it's funny.
Yeah, I remember the Brady Bunch. I was never much. I was never much of a TV watcher. I certainly remember the Brady Bunch. I don't remember that episode though.
Yeah, everyone has measles, and it's all the kids are sick all together, and how an opportune time for family bonding, that sort of thing. But then a few decades later, there's an episode. I think it's Law and Order, and the case is there's an anti-vaccine crusader who's being charged. I think the case is in, where her activism leads to a measles outbreak, and it's supposed to be scary.
was this fiction now, or
it's fiction, but it's ripped from the headlines, that same old
yeah
thing.
It did happen. I remember in Disneyland.
Yeah, so they're terrifying people, but I just remember my own living in memory. There was a time when something like measles and chickenpox wasn't considered a dangerous public health issue. It was just something you went through when you as a kid.
Exactly, it was a rite of passage.
Yeah,
as a matter of fact, a little bit before my time, I think in the 50s, kids used to deliberately infect each other with measles. They used to have what they call measles parties. Now, I don't remember that, but that was just a little. They were probably doing that when I was a little bit too young to remember it. But I, as I said, just you and me both. We knew kids that got sick, with chickenpox and measles, and they just bounced back. It was not a big deal. In fact, it was kind of funny. It was like stepping in. It was like winning the booby prize. I can remember.
We have like in my family albums, my mom took pictures of kids with chickenpox, and it was like, oh look, chickenpox, and that's when they had chickenpox and they had the pox. It wasn't like you were all horrified, but you want it as a kid because it's obviously less. If it's healthy to have it when you're a kid, it's of course considerably less inconvenient when it happens when you're 6 or 7 years old, as opposed to when you're 18 or something. So,
another thing I want to mention too is like the generation. My parents were born in the 1920s. And they only had, if you were born before 1940, roughly, when you were a child, there was only one vaccine administered, and that was smallpox. And, so the question is, I think of when I was young, when I was a little kid, all the adults around me, they had only had one vaccination. I never heard anything about anybody dying from any of these. I don't know how many different diseases now that they give vaccines for, something like 12 or 15, something like that. I mean, you never heard anything. Nobody ever said to me like, oh, you're so lucky. There's a DPT shot now and polio. Nobody ever said anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So how did everybody survive from that generation?
I think if you look at it, the statistics show that the dramatic drop in child mortality and morbidity began almost completed before the introduction of mass vaccination. It was just better diet, better sanitation,
sure,
environment, which would increase everyone's health. So it wasn't. It was really farmers and plumbers that saved everyone's lives. It wasn't doctors.
Yeah. That's pretty much common knowledge. I mean, among people in the know that vaccines had nothing to do with it, And let me also say, I'll also add, I did most of my third world traveling was in the 1980s, but in the early in the past 15 years, I've gone back to Asia and Central America. Once I learned about all that stuff, I said I'm never going to get another vaccine, and I was never vaccinated, and I never came down with any diseases. And people. Anybody who's listening, who's contemplating going to the third world, just don't worry about this stuff. I will say before I really should interject, especially in Africa, malaria is definitely something you want to avoid getting. It's spread by mosquitoes, but that's one thing you don't want to mess around with. Especially in Africa, it's very, very wide, very rife throughout the African continent. Except in the far south, it's kind of like. It tends to be kind of spotty and seasonal, and at high altitudes, mosquitoes can't live, I think, above 6,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
But just about everywhere else in sub-Saharan Africa, it is very, very. You want to take all kinds of precautions to avoid.
But it's not spread person to person, is it?
No.
So it's very different than the like. It's not a It's very different than say, the influenza or something.
No, yeah, it's the only way you can get it is by
Yeah.
being bitten by mosquitoes that are infected. Now, there is, I will say also, I had mentioned hepatitis A before. Hepatitis A is quite common throughout the third world, but, you know, as long, you know, there's no guarantees, but if, you know, my big thing is if you're going to travel to the third world, never, ever drink tap water and never trust anybody who tells you that the water is safe. Just always stick to water that's been boiled, like in tea or coffee, or bottled soft drinks, or
Which is
bottled
one of the
water.
reasons why you had the great improvement of health in the developed world of the 20th century was a clean source of drinking water, which was a huge
Absolutely.
Revolution.
Yes,
That changed
absolutely.
everything. That and you know, plumbing and clean water, the separation of the two between often that was the biggest improvement right now, was the ability to separate sewage water from drinking water. Take that for granted.
Yeah, you take it for granted, but when you know, I've seen I remember in India, which probably has the worst water in the worst tap water in the world. You know, in these third world countries, sometimes you just see you're walking along the sidewalk or in the street, and they just have you'll see streams of like grayish water, just I guess being pumped out of you know, hotels, restaurants, living quarters, and you know. Their plumbing is just so primitive, and I guess the drinking water gets mixed up. The tap water gets mixed up with this dirty water. So you just really want to avoid water at all costs, or vegetables that have been washed in water. So you really
well, that's
be
why you have all
careful
these
that way.
efforts like Bill Gates, Gavi, and a lot. They're all obsessed with injecting people with things when simple infrastructure improvement would save so many lives, as opposed to you know.
Well, Bill Gates is a subject in himself. I mean,
Yes.
and people like him. I mean, these people, they just have, you know, what I call it reptile brains. I mean, their mentality. Now, you must know, I think he in India, you know, I'm always wary of statistics, but I have read in, and I haven't seen any kind of commentary contradicting it, that he had a polio eradication program in India, I think from 2001 to 2015, something like that. And from what I've read, close to 500,000 Indian children had terrible reactions, many of them were paralyzed. I guess some of them died as well.
So he had his own cutter incident in India, right?
Well, it was more than just well, cutter incident. Yeah, that's worth talking about too, but this was much graver. You know, went on for a much longer time, and you know, from what I read, there was a warrant. There was some prosecutor in India, and he teamed up with some pharmaceutical big shot in India. Basically, just you know, going into all these villages, and I guess. You know, under false pretenses, you know, telling the parents that they were, you know, that this would save them from polio. And from what I read, there was a prosecutor that wanted to have him extradited and put on trial to face capital punishment, to face the death penalty for what he did there. But you know, it's kind of impractical imagining that somehow he's going to get extradited back to India. So, but he is just an absolute.
When you have people like Bill Gates who are advocates of population reduction and control, they're the ones spearheading, you know, supposed vaccination programs, and other claimed public health measures. From what I understand, Jonas Salk himself was an advocate of using, you know, needles and injections to control the population. I think he wrote a book called "Survival of the Wisest" or something.
Yes, I heard about that book. I never read it.
You can't get it anywhere.
Oh, is that right?
But it's out there. You know.
You know, that's interesting. You mentioned that's just one of the things. You know, people who take this, who think he's a great man for coming for, you know, discovering this polio vaccine. You mentioned the cutter incident. You know, a lot of people don't know about that. Actually, I read a very good book. I have it right in front of me here. Have you heard of this book, Polio: An American Story, by David Oshinsky?
I heard the title. I haven't read it, but
it's really worth reading. Mm-hmm. And what makes it interesting is this guy Oshinsky is not anti-vaccine at all. He's very much pro-vaccine, but he tells a story of this rat race for a polio vaccine in the 50s. And, you get to look at see these people, learn about them, what they're really like as people. And
Did they
really
call it Operation Warp Speed?
They might as well have called it Operation Warp Speed. It was the same kind of scare tactics against polio, which was really a very rare disease.
Don't be offended. What I'm going to do here, because the phone, I'm going to occasionally say something so you don't lose me. I think it might have something to do with that, where I stay quiet for a while.
Okay.
So I'm going to see. Apparently, we're staying connected, so I'm going to do that. So don't sound like this guy's being
right,
a jerk.
Fine.
So
that's fine.
Maybe I go maybe that'll work. So
okay. Yeah,
so go ahead, continue. Go.
Yeah, no, what I wanted to say was there was a lot of background information of what was going on during this rat race, and these guys, like, for example, Sabin and Salk really couldn't stand each other.
I know, that's a funny story. I think there's these scientists and they have these personality conflicts.
really bad. Yeah. When you hear the word scientist, you think of a very dignified, open-minded, serious kind of very intelligent person. It's not like that at all. But he had one very interesting anecdote. He had interviewed a guy in this book. Now, he interviewed, I think when the book was published, both Salk and Sabin had already died, I think in the 1990s. I think the book was published about 2005. Anyway, he interviewed a guy named Julius Jungner, who was an associate of Salk. And he had gone out to the Cutter Labs out in Berkeley, California, just to look at their operation. This was right around the time in April, or very just before, I think it was just before they released the Lust vaccine. And he took a look at their labs, and he was horrified. He said, these people don't know what they're doing. It just looks very sloppy, very unclean. And he came back to Salk, and he said, I can't, you can't be using this vaccine. I see all kinds of problems here, potential problems. And Salk told him, don't worry about it. I'll take care of it. And he never did take care. He never did a damn thing about it. And the Cutter vaccine was released. And within 2 weeks, I think there was something like, I don't know, 15 children. And, it was like a big thing. It was just like with the COVID vaccine, come and get your vaccine. We finally have a cure for polio.
Was there ever a polio epidemic?
Not really. I mean, I've read that 90% of the population is naturally immune to polio. So, and again, I was saying earlier, I had my parents, no adult that I knew ever said anything about polio. Like it was really, it just didn't happen. I remember I had one friend whose father had had polio and he had a slight limp in his leg. So there was polio around, but it was very, very rare. It was something like Lyme disease. That's scarce.
Well, it's fear driven, and this one, you had the development of modern media and magazines, and you had the iron lung and all that. It would scare a lot of people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. People got scared, just like they got scared with COVID. They're hearing all these phony statistics of how many people are dying, and most people are not very bright. They can be very easily misled. And I'm sure that was the case with polio.
And this is, of course, the early era of mass media, too, at the time. So
Yeah, it was on television. And but just to get back to what happened with the Cutter incident was that Salk allowed, he could have stopped it, but he didn't. There was a lot of money involved. And within 2 weeks, most people don't realize, very few people know this. Within 2 weeks, as I said earlier, a lot of kids, about 15 children died of it, and over 100 were paralyzed by it. They got like full-blown polio. And then everybody started, all the health bureaucrats, they went into panic mode. And I think it was on less than a month after it came out, on May 8th, I believe, 1955, the Surgeon General at the time, Leonard Shealy, he just brought the whole nationwide vaccination program to a screeching halt. He just stopped it. He said, "We got to get to the bottom of this." But my point, it was resumed later on, but people were much less enthusiastic about it. But the point I'm trying to make is the kind of person that Salk was. he knew there were potential problems with it. He could have stopped it, but he didn't. And meanwhile, the media is puffing him up to be some kind of scientific god who, saved millions, ended the scourge of polio. There's a very interesting actually, there's an interesting few pages in Oshinsky's book about the whole thing. It was being puffed up. It was gradually being puffed up, like people were being propagandized into believing, we're pretty close to a cure now. It's coming. It's coming. And then there was a huge press conference on April 12th, 1955, in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And just that the media went berserk over this guy. They just, he was like, as I said, they puffed him up into being a scientific god. And all of Salk's rivals, they were just totally disgusted with the whole atmosphere. They just, there's a lot of interesting quotes. I think I had some of them in my book. They were whole disgusted with the carnival atmosphere because they didn't like, a lot of his colleagues didn't like him at all. They considered him a very mediocre scientist who stole other people's ideas, and he was very kind of, but he was very talented at putting on this air of like a quiet, detached, humble scientist.
The photograph of him looking at the white coat.
Exactly. I mean, they say a picture is worth a thousand words. Yeah, looking at that flask, this visionary scientist, and it was just such a bunch of crap. So so that's where we stand with polio.
And there's the whole nature of disease, because it's a question whether it's caused by poliomyelitis by a virus or it's caused by toxins, because the paralysis is just a symptom of something, and some people associate it with the wide use of DDT, which is a neurotoxin. And also the clinical use of antibiotics, which compromises the gut if used or misused, which then would compromise the blood brain barrier and cause neurological damage and paralysis. But it wasn't a lone bug that's going to come and get you because you're swimming at the pool or something.
Right. What I speculate on, actually very late in my research, I had to add this on later. I speculated. I came across a book which I didn't read when I was researching. It was by what the hell is his name? I can't think of his name right now, but he was. I think the title of the book was something like "Polio: A History." I can't believe I forget the guy's name. But he was like kind of in the background. He was like a moderator. He was kind of like respected by everybody, but he wasn't. He had done some polio work in Connecticut in the 1930s, and he wrote about the history of polio. And I read that book very late after I had written the chapter and after I had completed that chapter. And the first 30 or 40 pages of his book is very interesting because it he mentions that prior to roughly 1800, there was virtually nothing about the symptoms of polio in the medical literature.
Mm-hmm.
It was, and he says it's something like it might as well have been non-existent. So I speculated that the first outbreak of polio, I think, was reported in the 1830s in England. So I speculated that this was caused by the smallpox vaccination.
Mm.
I mean, it's just a matter of putting two and two together and connecting dots. Of course, I can't prove that, but it certainly seems that way. And then the first outbreaks also, I think the first one in the U.S. was in Vermont. Also, like, I think in the mid-1800s. And again, it just follows. It came on the heels of these smallpox vaccination campaigns. And before that, it was like it didn't really exist, apparently, according to what he wrote. So,
yeah, I mean, a lot of people also associate with poisoning, like people who worked in tanneries and factories.
Yeah,
come down
exactly.
with paralysis, which was some people think even Franklin Delano Roosevelt had developed his polio. What they called polio was paralysis. He used to swim, I think, downstream from a tannery,
mm-hmm.
Which could have been in a stream. So again, polluted water which is, of course, rampant, and industrial pollution, particularly in the early industrial revolution, the factories and large cities, and you had the phenomenon of large concentrated urban areas, which then would just greatly increase the incidence of disease because of the unnatural environment and the high poverty rates at the time, you know.
Sure.
Just improving those conditions again, not so much. But then they like the business model, if you will, the idea of a heroic medicine is coming in with a drug or something that's going to come in and save everybody and get patent and make a lot of money off it. Instead of dealing with other social economic conditions in society, you know, or dealing with the liability that comes with mass poisoning like DDT or something, you know.
Right.
So you can't blame. So if you blame a virus or a bug, you can't sue God, right?
Right,
It's a
right.
way to avoid a liability in
You
these
know, just in
things.
the last minute while you've been speaking, I was just thumbing through my book. The name of that book that I had just mentioned is A History of Poliomyelitis by John Paul. So, you know, he was like, as I said, a background figure. You know, he was pro-vaccine, but it was just very interesting that the beginning of the book that he taught, you know, he wrote about the fact that it was pretty much unknown.
Well, I
So,
mean, some of the vaccines, of course, and the medical, I mentioned that sort of this corruption of public health and also the medical establishment in general. This is something that occurred early on, probably 19th, 20th, particularly the 20th century, with the development, you know, of the American Medical Association and these things and these organizations, and sort of the I guess the enthronement of allopathic medicine, or heroic medicine, and sort of the marginalization of natural path or homeopath or even integrative medicine, because the as big industry, and we talk about the Rockefellers how they kind of took over medicine in the early part of the 20th century, you know, with the with that the, what was that report again?
which report are you?
Rockefeller's advisor, when it sought to modernize medicine and close down a lot of med schools, and though obviously there was a lot of room for improvement then because medicine was in its infancy, so you had a lot of, you know, bad practices and probably snake oil salesmen. Ironically enough, Rockefeller's father was a snake oil salesman. He sold that what Nujol oil that would cure, it was like a petroleum-based product that would cure, claim to cure everything. John D. Rockefeller's father. But the oh what is it? Yeah, Flexner. Sorry, Flexner.
Oh, Flexner, yeah.
Yeah, the Flexner report. Well, that was an attempt to sort of cartelize or monopolize medicine, and
Yeah.
and basically what it did is it made petroleum-based products, i.e., you know, pharmaceuticals, the basis for modern intervention, intervention, medicine, heroic medicine, drugs, the miracle drugs, and these things. And so you have that, so, and then you have big capital, big business takeover of medicine, and then you have, you know, this idea we have a lot of money being invested in certain standards of care and treatment, and there's a lot of capital investment. We see it with cancer treatments, the standard of care, and so they're not gonna, it's not gonna respond well to, say, revolutionary or treatments that upset that business model, if you will. And we see that today, where everything else is sort of marginalized, and everything's about giving drugs, and the pharmaceutical
Yeah,
industry advertises it on television, so there's no real trust in journalism, and they bought out all the medical journals in the 70s and these things. So that's
yes,
this,
all
yeah.
right. Yeah, you're very well versed in what's going on.
Yeah.
Yeah, what they call the health care. Yeah, you know, I came across, while I was researching my book, I came across a lot of names. I did come across the name of Abraham Flexner. I didn't mention him. I just never really looked any further. But now I realize I read Carl Hamer's. He wrote a very good article in I forget what issue of the Barnes Review about the whole corruption that began with the Flexner brothers. And you know, this is going to sound funny. I also came across a name of Anthony Fauci many times, but I never saw his picture either. And I said that, you know, there's just so many people you can talk about, and I never brought him up either. But of course, this, you know, I finished the book before the whole COVID thing started. So, yeah, so It was funny though. I remember reading about him and said, reading some quotes from him. I said, "This guy's kind of a weasel. I don't know who he is. I don't know how important he is, but he's not being straight." So anyway, it's yeah.
Well, talk yeah, the shifting stories, like the shifting, about the COVID jab, where he actually claimed he said it wouldn't. He said it would.
Okay.
Quoting again.
Yeah, you were saying you were talking about Fauci claiming this and that.
This and that, the mask, the vaccines doesn't stop. Yeah, it does stop. Does stop infection.
You know, sometimes you just have to look at the kind of people that get involved in this. And I talk about this a little bit in my book. Just look at the kind of people who get involved with vaccines. I mean, we talked about Gates. I'm sure you're familiar with Paul Offit. Really horrible man. Even worse is Peter Hotez.
Yes.
I mean, he is really a nut. He is really
he actually called for a law to have people criticizing Fauci, make it illegal to criticize Anthony Fauci because there's anti-science.
He is really and he's gotten himself into trouble. He found himself in a lawsuit with Cheryl Atkinson. I don't know if you're familiar with her. She was a former CBS reporter.
That's right. She's the one that her reporting broke. She's the one that was it 2009? Was it the bird flu fake pandemic or a swine?
Yeah, she's written some nice stuff, and I think she's a nice lady, but she's really kind of, she just doesn't really see the whole picture. But you know, I log onto her website once in a while. I just kind of surf the net and see what different people are saying. But then you also look at the kind of people, and then we have Rochelle Walensky.
Mm-hmm.
Just a witch. I mean, anybody, you know, most people just don't get it, though. They just don't have that intuition. What a liar she was. She was and still is. And then Mandy Cohen. Then just look at the kind of people in, like, all these celebrities, the kind of people who really came down on anti-vaxxers and were really pushing the COVID shot. You know, people like Whoopi Goldberg, Madonna.
Mm-hmm.
Howard Stern. I mean, just really, just idiotic people. And then are you familiar with that? I don't watch television. I don't have a television, but I heard about that. Stephen Colbert with his vaccine skit. Oh. Do you know about that?
Oh, yeah. I did it to the song Tequila.
Yeah, something like that.
His vaccine. And he's dancing with vaccines. People dressed up as syringes.
Oh, my God. I mean, so that just looking at the kind of people who are adamantly pro-vaccines says a whole lot.
Well, it doesn't also show how integrated or totalitarian the system has become when all of media and journalism and the medical industrial complex and government all working to one objective. I mean, you think in a free society there'd be much more resistance given the evidence, or at least for being skeptical, right? Just for voicing skepticism about these stupendous claims, all you get is to sort of be shattered down and threatened, or lose your job, or you're called names, and like it doesn't really inspire confidence in their case when that's their reaction, when they can't manifest any evidence or an argument for their case. They just
things have changed a little bit. I mean, yeah. I think word is getting around. About I notice, you know, again, I don't have a television, but I do go on the internet. I take a quick look at ABC, CBS, NBC, and CNN, and I notice the tone has changed somewhat. They're not so sure of themselves anymore. They're not coming down hard on anti-vaxxers as they were, because I think word is getting around that so many people have suffered severe reactions, severe life-changing reactions, mm-hmm. or have been killed by the vaccine, by the COVID jab. So I think, including people in the news media. So, you know, I think the dialogue has changed to, I think the tide has turned as far as all this, the importance of getting a COVID vaccine and all that. I did read that 7 million people have gotten boosters, which is pretty sad. But still, I mean, that shows a really countrywide lack of enthusiasm for it. I mean, people just don't have, people have lost a lot of faith in the whole system. And the
Yeah, and the whole
media,
like
the
public health scientists that just can't. Then what it was exposed is just how compromised public health was. Working with people like Gates, Gavi, the Imperial College of London, and how they, what was that, the Event 201, where they tabletop exercised the
Oh,
whole
yeah.
thing. It was all like planned. And then it's sort of it's this incestuous relationship between the World Health Organization, Bill Gates, Gavi, and his investments, and Johns Hopkins, and how,
It's a whole interlocking, elitist system. Yeah. So.
There's no like outside third party holding anyone accountable, because even like these bureaucrats are all these so-called scientists, they're all tapped in like Bill Gates funding.
Oh, yeah.
It's like,
Oh,
so at the end
yeah.
of the day, your public health authority is a college dropout. So much for like science and credentialism. They're doing the bidding of these, basing a, it's a bit, you're just satisfying a certain business model. It's nothing to do with public health or well-being of people. In fact, it's the quite opposite.
Yeah. No, Gates is he is really a pretty well, he's unique in the fact that first of all, I don't understand how his mind works, and he's just, he's one of the richest people in the world. And as you said, it's just and he's able to push. I just you ask yourself, I mean, he's done these things not only in India, which I mentioned earlier, in Africa as well, and little kids start dying and he just moves on to another country. Another venture, another scheme, and he doesn't seem his mentality is such that he just cannot learn from his past mistakes, and he doesn't care. And as you alluded to, also, it's his this might be tied into his whole issue of there's too many people in the world, so vaccines can be used to induce sterility and fertility. And kill people off. I think you must have seen that clip of his. He was giving a TED talk.
Yes.
Yeah, that just. I don't know if that was a Freudian slip, but he said, he said something to the effect that vaccines, if we do a good job with vaccines and reproductive education, this kind of thing, we can reduce the population of the world by 10 to 15%. Yeah, you've seen that. A lot of people have seen that, but. Maybe not enough, just to get a grip on how this guy thinks.
Well, he's Malthusian, he's misanthropic, and as most billionaires are, because billionaires, I think, fear that if there are too many people, that they'll lose control and their vast wealth, because they consume so much. Look at his house. I mean, he talks about the environment, but he owns it. Well, like 40. One of his homes is like 40,000 square feet, and
Yeah, well,
which is typical of these people, the people that
quite the
that.
hypocrite.
Yes.
No, I'll say myself too. I think, having traveled a lot, especially, countries like India. I mean, India has well over 1 billion people. I mean, I have to agree, there are too many people in this world. As a matter of fact, I remember when I was in Calcutta, I remember seeing a trolley, a streetcar with a campaign to have less children. I do think. The world will run out of resources eventually with so many people, but who am I? I don't have any.
Who are the
I would
people?
not
Who
put, I
are
don't know how it's going to
the
work.
who
I
are
think
the
nature will
which is
probably
what is the surplus
take over
population?
and somehow reduce the human population on its own. I don't know how. Well, when people run out of food, I mean, I guess that's one way, but I think to myself, who are these people that they think they have the power to, take matters like this into their own hands and impose their own so-called solutions. So I don't know. I don't have the answers. I mean, I was actually kind of surprised when you are you familiar with you must know Jane Goodall, who did a little work with chimpanzees.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I thought I lost you again. Yeah, just recently she went up in with the World Economic Forum. She basically said the same thing. I mean, she's kind of, and I don't think she's an evil person, but she said, yeah, there's too many people in this world, and we got to do something about it. But just to go to align oneself with an outfit like the World Economic Forum, is something that really kind of disturbs me. Somebody like her, who I believe is a pretty good moral person, but you know, these people get involved. I don't know.
Well, you
As
have
I
a
said, I
problem.
don't.
One thing is, you do have a problem of development, like in the third world, where the population exceeds your food production. And, but then there, it's aided by, you know, the population is aided by Western aid, you know, which boosts the population beyond which it, maybe it would be in the first place, which then creates a problem. They're dependent on foreign aid and the food and the food aid and things like that to keep the you know the current population at its current size. The one thing is, what I think do notice is there's been although they'll talk a lot about boosting the population, helping the population, like in the third world in Africa, they don't encourage reproduction in the first world, you know. And so
Right.
there's an anti-natalist agenda in the third world. So then, if anything, if you look at the right now, there's probably too many young people to support the current system, as you know, countries like Japan. So you do have a demographic winter coming because of so many decades of like promoting contraception and abortion in the West. And so now the system isn't sustainable anymore. But then the solution is to import people from the third world, where you know, good
Well,
example of what
that's
they're doing
such.
with Europe, or what's going on in the U.S. border right now, where the governor
Yeah.
just simply had a stand down, and they're literally they're eight they're spending they're I think they're giving offering $2,000 a month to people to come into the country illegally.
That I didn't hear. I know that the situation is totally out of control, but that's no solution at all. I think we know what. Well, like we can get off into another subject completely, talking about who's behind this and who wants to, displace the white race and
Well, we
there's
have
more.
what's going on. I mean, you said you've traveled. I'm going to switch gears. You said you actually have been to the Middle East.
Oh yeah, quite a few. You want to get off? You want to switch gears and talk about that now? I don't know how much time we have.
Let's talk about they're trying to. Some people it appears are trying to start World War III over some sand in the desert.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy. Yeah, I've been to. Yeah, I've traveled. I've been to eight Arab countries, including three of. Israel. Let me say that it's bordered by Egypt, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. I've been to Egypt, Syria, and Jordan. I've been to Israel a couple of times, and yeah, I have a completely different take on what's going on. I've also been to Iran. That was in the 1980s. I traveled there, and I went to Iran. I traveled alone. In all of the Arab world except Algeria, I was with a group, and I've been to Turkey. I traveled around Turkey on my own, one of my favorite countries, and Iran. I went to Iran in 2016 with a small group for 8 days, and it's just completely. Let me just read this very quickly. One of my favorite novels of all time is 1984, and I still have my copy from high school. It's falling apart 50 years. This is one of the most important passages in the book. He says, "War prisoners apart, the average citizen of Oceania never sets eyes on a citizen of either Eurasia or East Asia, and he is forbidden the knowledge of foreign languages. Now, here's the important sentence. If he were allowed contact with foreigners, he would discover that they are creatures similar to himself and that most of what he has been told about them is lies. The sealed world in which he lives would be broken, and the fear, hatred, and self-righteousness on which his morale depends might evaporate." And when I think about that, when I take that statement into account, I just think about the Arab world. That people, this whole business of Islam being a violent religion, and they hate Christianity, they hate. West of the hate America. It's just such a bunch of crap. I mean, I don't, and I let me also say this. I don't really particularly like Arabs. That might sound a little nasty, but they do. Overall, I just found them to be kind of rude. Not all of them, of course, but as a general rule, rude. The worst thing about them is that they're dishonest in petty ways. Every time money changes hands, I was constantly being cheated, overcharged. And after a while, you just kind of develop a siege mentality. It's just constant. you know, whether it's a container of yogurt, a hotel room, a bus ride, just constantly being overcharged. And, they wouldn't do the same thing to their fellow Arabs.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, to a foreigner, they had no qualms about cheating you. That's the one thing that really drove me out of my mind about those countries. But this business about hating Americans, and it's just such a bunch of crap. I never felt in any danger. No, and by the way, nobody ever brought up the subject of religion. Nobody's looking to proselytize, you know, to tell you that Islam is a superior religion. And I walked in like late at night in Damascus, the streets of Damascus, Cairo, Amman, Jordan. I never felt any fear whatsoever. Morocco, just a little bit. Morocco kind of is really not near it's like the western edge of the Arab world.
Mm-hmm.
in northwest Africa. Although it's also probably the most exotic country too. Really interesting place. But again, it's perfectly safe to travel in these countries. I also, you know, when I went to Israel, I was in Israel twice, actually, each time about 11 or 12 days, in 1980 and 1984. The second time I was there, I rented a car for a week, and I picked up a lot of hitchhiking Israeli soldiers. And, you know, I just wanted to kind of get into their mind, get into their head, see how they think. I would say over the week, I picked up about a dozen of them. And two of them, I remember, they really struck me as really cold-blooded killer types. I wish I could have kicked them out of the car. And some of them were, I really didn't like too much. But I would say about half of them, they were just kind of regular guys. And we talked about Lebanon a little bit, and they dreaded going to Lebanon. They kind of grumbled about being in the army. And they were just, you know, kind of like,
yeah.
You know, I grew up on Long Island, and I knew, you know, quite a few Jews who were just regular, kind of regular people, ordinary people, not bad people. And they struck me as being the same way. And I would bet any amount of money right now that, you know, they're massing along the border of Gaza right now. I can guarantee you that they don't want to be there. They wish they, you know. And again, they're not very good soldiers either. Not that I would be, but they're not, you know, they're pretty scared about going into battle, okay? So that's the drift I got. And I just want to say, you know, I don't know if you log on to a lot of these conservative websites. I'm just totally, you know, what we call conservatism incorporated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people like Charlie Kirk, Sean Hannity, Bill O'Reilly, all these people, this absolute fanaticism that's going on right now is painting the Hamas as a terrorist group. You know, I don't have the exact statistics, but I would bet that the number of innocent Arabs who have been killed by Israelis as compared to the number of innocent Israelis who have been killed by Arabs, I wouldn't be surprised if it's 100-1. I mean, people, it's like all these atrocities of the past, like especially what happened in Lebanon, you know, in the 1980s, and all these wars that Israel has started. I mean, they've killed so many more innocent people than the other way around. And I also have my reservations about what's going on, about whether this was a false flag. I don't know. I'm kind of undecided about that, whether Netanyahu may have planned this whole thing ahead of time just as a pretext to completely, run these people out of Gaza altogether and just annex that whole territory. And if that's the truth of the matter, I don't know, but I think he really bit off more than he could chew this time, because it's not looking really good right now.
Well, the PR thing, initially there's a lot of sympathy for Israel, given the Jewish dominance of media in the West and the United States and throughout Europe. But the statements of many of the Israeli officials about, you know, wiping them all out, they're all being terrorists, and show this genocidal, you know, bloodlust that was exhibited last week after the initial attack, turned a lot of people off. And now you have this full court press, there's like shut down debate on the matter. From what I understand, in Germany, they're arresting pro-Palestinian protesters. In England or Great Britain, it's illegal to fly a Hamas flag or something. in a
Yeah, I've
protest.
read a few things
Yeah.
about that. But what you said about the bloodlust in Israel, it's also over here.
Yes.
And you expect it from people like Mark Levin and Michael Savage and Laura Loomer, just
Well, they're
Ben
calling for nuclear
Shapiro.
war. And they're saying
Yeah,
if we don't back them up, there's going to be a nuclear war. I think Ben Shapiro said a nuclear exchange. Like exchange, who else are they,
Ben, yeah,
who else is
they're
going to
very.
fire weapons at first of all, how do you detonate a nuclear weapon there? It seems to me they're implying the Samson option where they attack European cities.
Well, but yeah, I mean, who was his name? Seymour Hirsch wrote a book about the Samson option.
Yeah.
Although a much better book. Have you read Michael Collins Piper's The Golem? That's even a better book. I
The
don't have
Golem?
the Golem, Golem.
Oh no,
Have
that's
you?
I'm sure. I'm not familiar with that title. I'm figuring it was like Judas Goat and Final, Judgment and all that, so.
Well, yeah. Well, basically, that this is mentality among some, I don't know, among some of the Israeli leadership, and I'm sure a good chunk of the people, that if Israel's survival is ever threatened, they're just going to destroy the whole world. They're going to take down the whole world.
Yeah, and
Which is,
we're supposed to be worried about Iranians' nuclear program. It's like
which probably doesn't even exist. I don't
doesn't even
know, but
exist. And then you have, well, how did Israel get these nukes? Oh, that like opens up a whole can of worms. So that goes back to the Kennedy assassination.
yeah, really.
NUMEC and look into that.
Let me just also, while you bring up Iran, let me just say, as I said, I went there in 2016, and I've been to 97 countries, and I never felt more welcomed as a U.S. citizen than I was in Iran. They are just an absolutely wonderful, very sweet people. And by the way, if anybody listening to this doubts me, there is a travel writer named Rick Steves. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's written a lot of guides. He's a best-selling guidebook writer, mostly about Europe. But he went to Iran. I think I don't know. It was 2009. And you can go on. And he's apolitical. He's not. He wasn't sticking up for their. Actually, he was a little bit critical of their political stance. But he has a lot of stuff. He did some videos, and he gave talks around the States about how wonderful the people of Iran were. And we really have to find a way to get along with them. And that was my experience there. That's the thing about travel too. I knew it was called the Islamic Republic of Iran, but when I went there, I asked around a little bit. We had actually there was two different. We had two different tour guides. One, and they were very different. One was a young guy, kind of tall, handsome, very. Reflective, quiet, sensitive kind of guy, and the other one was an older one, a guy about 70, and he was a completely different personality. And so I asked both of them a lot of questions. I sat whenever I could. I sat in the front seat, just asked them a lot of questions about what the country was like. And I remember, they have some law, and basically it's a free country. It really is, and not many people. It's almost like here. I mean, the people that are very religious are out in the countryside. Kind of like the Bible Belt, rural areas. But over there, a lot of people, it's very secular. And one thing I missed, one thing I always loved was the muezzin's call to prayer. You probably heard that sound, from the mosque. And there was very little of that in Iran. And I learned that really not that many people are religious at all. And, I asked them. They have a few laws I didn't agree with. There's a total ban on alcohol. I do like having my IPA or my Pinot Grigio at the end of the day, so I kind of missed that a little bit. But then the first guy we said, he said, "Look," he said something to me like, and you figure you'd hear that there's a ban on alcohol, and you'll be punished really severely if you're caught with it. He said, "Look," he goes, "if you want it, you can get it. People smuggle it in." From neighboring countries all the time. It's not. It's almost like it was like prohibition, kind of. They just if you get caught, you just get a slap on the wrist. And another thing that really surprised me was that, and I learned a lot talking to the older guide. He kind of said, he kind of missed the good old days of the Shah. This is funny. We're riding in the bus, and the driver. Obviously, he's Iranian, but I don't think he understood English. And And our guy there is right a couple of feet away from him, and he's calling the Ayatollah Khomeini. He goes, he was a monster. And he's just saying all kinds of really bad things about him, right? Just a few feet away from the driver. Totally unconcerned about whether he's understood any of this. So, and again, he was when we were in the hotel for a little while in Isfahan, he was saying the same thing out loud, not caring who heard him. So, yeah, you find out it's just the situation there is just completely different. So, I will say that I remember, and this is very interesting too. There were a few places we went to. One, I forget what town we were in. It might have been Isfahan. No, I think it was a smaller town. Anyway, we went into this like kind of a courtyard, and the entrance on the entrance there was a big sign that said "Down with America, Down with Israel." It was really spelled out. You know, you couldn't miss it. So I said to the guide, I said, this is the younger guy. I said, is that okay if I take a picture of that? And he kind of winced, and he said, the people don't like it. You know, I could tell I hurt his feelings. I could tell, like, he felt like, I don't want you taking a picture of this and going back home and showing people this and thinking that this is typical of the country. He said, the people don't like it, this heavy-handed kind of propaganda.
Well, I've heard people talk about it. E. Michael Jones has traveled there, given speeches there. And he was talking how he'll be in a huge crowd. Everyone's singing "Death to America, Death to the Great Satan." Then he'll be introduced to them as an American, and they all want to meet him and shake his hand. They see the distinction.
Absolutely,
the government and the people, and so that's just an expression. Because if you look at it, what they think of America, the Great Satan, is that it's hard to argue with them, considering the foreign policy of the United States and,
of course,
you know, what the United States stands for these days, which is global, homo, constant intervention, and also doing the bidding of Israel, because they're the ones, the Jewish lobby controls foreign policy, has a sort of a stranglehold on policy in the United States, which for various reasons we can get into. And that isn't just crude anti-Semitism, is just acknowledgement of the reality of inordinate Jewish power in the United States and throughout the West, as we see now with the current crisis in Gaza. Did you see the thing with the various Jewish billionaires are now cutting off the money spigots to the various Ivy League schools because they're allowing students to voice their opinion on this?
Yeah, I read a little bit about that. There's all kinds of crazy stuff going on. Actually, I kind of like the fact that a lot of these, there are, even though these people don't belong in the country, they're really raising their voices. I mean, people that are sympathetic to the Palestinians.
Of course, they're in the country because of Jewish immigration policy.
Yeah, exactly. It's come back to bite.
You want a diversity, right?
You want a diversity. You got it, baby.
So, I mean, if everyone were like white Protestants, they'd be loving Israel.
I know. That's the ironic thing.
And even Black Lives Matter, because you know, which is a golem of Jewish power, has come out and condemned the Israelis because they see white people bombing brown people. And so they have to get them back into shape, got to crack the whip, so to speak.
Well, yeah, that's a little wild, but the expression politics makes strange bedfellows.
Yes.
So, yeah, so.
Well, that's a good example. How do you make sense of these things? Like, a lot of black nationals will adopt Arab names, even though Arabs were the most cruel slave traders.
I never thought of that. Yeah, that's funny too.
Really? Do you really Muhammad and these names? Just you want to be the Arab slave trade? And you know, it's like there was no abolition movement in the Arab world. The fact that there isn't still any. So,
mm-hmm. You know. Yeah. So yeah, like I said, Iran, it's very safe to go to the West Bank, Turkey. Actually, things are getting pretty crazy. Before we started doing this program, a few minutes before that, I went on and I saw that there's a lot of all these capitals in the region. Even though Turkey is kind of on the, I wouldn't really call Turkey in the Middle East, but kind of like right on the border of the Middle East.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of stuff going on in Istanbul. They're storming the Israeli consulate, and all these Arab capitals. A lot of things.
Yeah, you had the hospital bombing, where they're trying to blame on Hamas.
Yeah. Well, that's a typical Jewish lie.
Yeah, it wasn't one of those Hamas rockets that did that. At least not what I saw from seeing the correct video of what occurred. So,
Yeah, just like the Liberty was a case of mistaken identity. They thought it was an Egyptian
whoops.
ship.
Yeah, we have
I
two.
mean, they just
I think we
lie
have.
about everything.
I think we have aircraft carriers now, so maybe they'll bomb it. They'll bomb our ships and blame it on that old trick.
Yeah. They come up with every trick in the book. Let me just, I don't know, are we running out of time or do you have a few
We
more
got some
minutes?
left here. Want to say something? Go ahead.
I just wanted to say the things I did spend when I was in Israel. I mentioned I picked up those Israeli soldiers and hitchhiking. I just want to mention a few things I saw. And again, it's what you see with your own eyes. That's all I trust. So I did see, I spent some time in Jerusalem. Jerusalem is an incredible city. Over above and beyond all these the current issues. I mean, it just has a tremendous historical magic to it. The old city I'm talking about. And well, Jerusalem is kind of well. That's the Israelis pretty much control Jerusalem. And but I did spend 3 days. I spent 2 days in a little village called Sa'ir, Sa'ir. Now, how that came about was I met these Arab guys, these Palestinian guys, and I don't remember where I met them, but before I knew it, I was becoming their personal taxi. They were really kind of they were very, very friendly, but they were taking advantage of me. And we have to drive around to see my friends, this and that. But I did, and one of the guys' name was Mohammed, and he was the one. He spoke very good English, and he invited me to his parents' house for a couple of days. So I spent a couple of days at that house. It was just outside of Hebron, and his parents, they didn't speak English, but they were very, very nice. And his uncle was there too, a very cultured man, and he was fluent in English. And he said, "Listen, he goes, any minute the Israeli soldiers, they can just come barging in and arrest us." And I remember he said this too. He goes, and I said, "Yeah, I said to him, I said I'm not like most Americans. I understand, what you're going through." And he just said, kind of very cynically, "Yes, and you will go back to America, and you will do nothing." And what was I supposed to say? So, but that, and they had a small house, but it was modest, very nice house. And I remember the second morning I went out. I don't know, I just wanted to step outside, get some fresh air, whatever, walk around a little bit, and there was an Israeli. Some kind of less than 5 minutes, okay,
Okay.
only. So I was talking about, I just stepped outside of that house in Sa'ir, and I see an Israeli armored vehicle coming down a quiet country lane, and nothing happened, but the soldiers just glowering at me, which was kind of, I could just feel the tension. And are you familiar with I think it's pronounced Jenin, Jenin. It's kind of a big town on the West Bank. There's been a
I've
lot
heard,
of trouble there.
yeah, I've heard, yeah.
I was staying like in a really ramshackle hotel, completely the front was like completely open to the outside, just absent-mindedly watching TV with a bunch of Arab guys. And all of a sudden, this Israeli jeep just veers over to the curb. You must have noticed that as a rental car, and they were probably wondering what that was all about. So they come barging in, and right away these guys just point to me, say, "I'm American," or whatever. It was a very close word in Arabic to Amerikish or something like that. So one of them says to me, "Are you American?" So I said, "Yes." He said, "Tourist?" I said, "Yes." So they just thought about that for a few seconds. Then he says, "Have a nice trip," and then they just left. But again, you just see the harassment, the tension. These two armed soldiers just coming barging in. Then one other scene stays in my mind. It was just outside of Hebron. I was in a market, and there was two young, I call them squatters. They call themselves settlers, probably from Brooklyn or Miami Beach, just walking slowly through the market. Remember, they had gym shorts, yarmulkes on, and Uzis strapped to their back, and just kind of exchanging glances with the Arab merchants. Just very, very cold, silent tension. I could really pick that up. And then of course, 10 years after I was there, you probably know about Baruch Goldstein, that doctor from Brooklyn, just walked into a mosque and he just started gunning everybody down. I think he killed about 30 Arabs, and wounded about 100 before they grabbed him and just beat him to death. Yeah, so, you know, there's a lot. You could just sense the tension. Although I didn't see any violent incidents and I really didn't see anything, but you could feel it, you know. And I think the people in Gaza had it even worse. You know, it was just basically, well, from everything, I didn't go to Gaza, but I just, from everything I've read, it's basically just a huge open air concentration camp, you know, just blockaded and people just being harassed and, you know, arrested for not for on the flimsiest of reasons and jailed and just, you know, just a hellish existence. And, you know, I think they finally had enough. As again, I don't know if this was a false flag, but I think if it was, I mean, I think, you know, a lot of the Palestinians who took part in it really felt the rage, and it was really just boiling for such a long time. So, but anyway, what happens there is nobody knows yet, and I think that's going to be that'll be the subject of another show with me or somebody else who is really keen on what's going on there. So,
Well, yeah, I mean the Netanyahu prime ministership, his government, recently he's had to invite a lot of the extremists into his Ben Gvir, I think, is one of them, who actually
yeah,
advocate genocide. So it's even more unstable than
openly.
before, yeah, because that's his coalition government, the Likud coalition government. And it's full
You
of
know, and
these,
I have the feeling a lot of his own people call him the crime minister.
Yes.
So I think, yeah, I think he's, you know, he's, I think, well, he's aligned himself with the real fanatics.
Yes.
Even though he looks like a, you know, he doesn't wear that dress,
No.
and he doesn't wear a yarmulke too often, but you know, he's as extreme as you can get, and I think a lot of his people don't like him. And if you know, I think he's in a losing situation because if this was a false flag, that means he sacrificed some of his own people, you know, to pull off what he had in mind. And I think he's going to be, you know, if that's the case, if word gets around, he's not going to be very popular. And on the other hand, if this really was a surprise attack, then it just shows how completely incompetent, you know, things are over there. That these people just were able to sneak in and, you know, and pull off this attack. But I don't know. Again, as I said earlier, I really don't. My mind is open to all possibilities, and it's going to be pretty tragic. And what's going to happen there? I'm not going to make any predictions. I just don't know.
Yeah,
But I
it's
don't think
amazing
it.
how ill-informed or mind-controlled the American public is about this matter when they can portray this as unprovoked. I heard that unprovoked. What are you kidding me? Since 1948, Israel has expelled hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from their
Of
homes,
course.
has occupied all the historic area, the Palestine, has pretty much given its army a green light to kill thousands of local people, and has established, I guess it has to be an apartheid regime to stay a Jewish state, because that's just the real estate there. But again, he's Netanyahu, as I mentioned, has allied himself with these extremists that have called for the extermination of Palestinian people, including children. What's that one lady, Aliette Shaked, who says calls them little snakes? They got to kill them. So when the Arabs strike back, it's called terrorism. And obviously, there's
Of
going to be
course.
violence back and forth. The cycle of violence began in the 1930s. When a bunch of Polish Jews started emigrating to the country to vindicate Zionism, to take the land, and they started using terrorism. Then there's been one attack after another, reprisals back and forth. So often people I hear often say this is a 1,000-year-old confrontation. No, it isn't. First of all, Islam does only dates back to the 7th century, so it's not that's not
Yeah.
that's a, but this is a modern. This is like a 100-year, relatively modern confrontation that is a product of Zionism, because it's disputed real estate at the end of the day.
You know, the sad thing is that you and I know this, and the people listening to the show know it, and yet the people of this country at large, including just about every conservative, they have really have no idea. I mean, the record is there. They would do a little if they would do a little if they would look into it a little bit, but no, they don't. I mean, they have their own conservative the people like the conservative spokesmen they look up to. They believe what they say. Of course, everything is censored on in the media. Never anything about this, or just a very little tiny bit about it, you know, on CNN ABC, CBS, NBC.
You know, if you speak up
But
about it, you find out your Jewish paymaster, you know, is going to get you fired or kicked out of university or
of
something.
course, it happens all the time.
And we're
By the
seeing it
way,
right now, so.
by the way, when we got cut off, I just quickly went on the computer, and I just see something. I don't know. Again, this might be a lot of exaggeration, but it said pro-Palestinian demonstrators have just taken over Capitol Hill. So a lot of interesting things are happening, and it's, I think in the end, it's not gonna bode well for Israel. So,
Uh-oh, are they insurrectionists?
I don't know. No, I don't think it was a January 6th kind of deal. But
Okay.
but again, I mean, when people they can't the news media just can't hide all these pro-Palestinian demonstrations that are taking place, and that gives the Palestinian side a lot of legitimacy. They start seeing, hey, there's a lot of people that
Well, a lot of
you know.
Americans, even former Christian Zionists, are going to look at it and say, is it worth it? I mean,
Well, I hope that's the case.
yeah.
I don't know. I mean,
It's not worth it. It's not morally defensible. I mean, it's,
no.
no.
And one good thing that's never going to happen that happened in Iraq. I just cannot see any American ground troops being sent, no matter what happens,
Well,
to
here,
any
Janet
country.
Yellen, our Jewish Secretary of the Treasury, is saying we can afford another war.
That's what she's. No, I didn't catch that. We
She had an
can't. She
interview.
said
She
we.
says, can we afford it? She said, yes, we can. We definitely can afford another war. This is our Jewish secretary. Of course, our Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, went there and declared himself a Jew. Of course, he's
Yes.
a son of Zionist activists. So this is the type of government we have.
Well, hopefully more and more people are seeing through it. I just don't. I have a very small social circle, and I never bring up vaccines. I never bring up any kind of controversial topics because, I just they just live in an alternate reality, and I don't want to disturb that. But I can't even with my family and my few friends. I don't really see them feeling as strongly as some of these, the Sean Hannitys and the Bill O'Reillys and these kind of people.
Well, from what I understand, if you look at the polling, it's like people over age 65, your group that are Zionists, because these are the white
Well, yeah, we were brought
conservatives.
up with all those myths, especially that
Yeah.
the Israelis being the good guys, and yeah, definitely, I think it's the older people.
And it's part of the younger crowd, which is less white because of immigration policy and antinatalist
That
policies,
too.
whatever. But they can't be guilted into supporting Jews like the white people
Yes,
can.
that's a very interesting point.
Yeah. That white guilt isn't going to
So,
work on the newcomers that are coming.
yeah.
So,
So,
okay, well, I
so.
think altogether, I think we got like close to an hour and a half. I said to have you that long, and I'll patch this interview together. The
Yeah,
different.
we touched on a lot of stuff. It was very enjoyable and.
I think for the time we actually were connected, it's clear. So I think our listeners should be
Okay.
able to make sense
Yeah,
of.
we got to work on that. Maybe I got to start getting on Skype. Like I said, I'm kind of a caveman with this stuff, just doing this by my landline. So
Okay.
whatever though. It was a good talk, and I hope people will tune in and then learn a few things, and hopefully maybe I'll be on another time.
Yeah, sure.
We'll see.
Yeah,
We'll see what happens.
I'll reach out, and I'll in the meantime I will put the interview, I'll edit it and post it, and I'll provide the
Okay.
links to your website and your book and everything. So
Okay, sounds good. Thanks a lot, Tim.
you enjoy your evening. Thank you so much for coming
Okay,
on.
you too. Okay,
Bye-bye.
bye-bye now.